Go ahead, Gordon.
Well, I mean, you'd have to throw in the occultic secret societies, too. You're talking about who's really running the show, but...
Well, we talk about government, but I don't consider it any longer politicians. To me, government now is just a facade for those who really do run the country. Like I said, I mean, people who run for office, people who run this country don't run for office.
They're salesmen.
Yeah, and they'll take the tomato hit every so often from the public, but that's, you know, that's what they get paid for. And to rail against Republicans and Democrats is now a complete distraction. I mean, you were better off going down a 30 Rock with pitchforks than you are to go to D.C. But people aren't getting that. And the one thing I've said time and time again, and that is, while these people are trying to vote for good government and good candidates, and there's a couple of rogues out there who I believe were good. Adam Putnam from Florida was one of them, but he got out of D.C., and I think I understand why. But the, you know, but my point is, you know, they're concerned about corporations like Monsanto and, you know, blah, 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 you know, the Frankenfood and all this, and yet they don't realize that the reason these corporations get away with it is because the people they vote for office are giving them slack. And they're not
right, and it doesn't matter what party. They all, no. In the end, they get support from both parties,
you know,
whoever they're giving money to, whoever their boys are. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing just the things, what, you know, if you ask the average, like I've always said, if I could institute a reform, I would start selecting Congress by lot, do away with elections totally. You would have a much more representative system. Just have, if you want to be a congressman, you put your name in a hat. If you're a citizen, you're not a convicted felon, I would say, if your name gets pulled out, you're in Congress for 2 years. I'd rather see that than what we have now, because what we have now are people racing to see how corrupted they can get elected.
Don, you remember this from that book by Lundgren, The Rich and the Super Rich. He documents how in the early 20th century, and traditionally, of course, the super rich, the dynastic families, they typically stood by the Republicans. That was their way to enrich themselves. It typically Republican cronyism. But later on in the 20th century, and by the time of LBJ, he documents how the super rich figured out how they could make a lot of money with this great society thing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they saw, well, and he also says that although that these families traditionally were Republican, if there was a Democrat in the White House, the door was never closed to them.
Yeah.
Specifically says that, and that's true. I mean, you know, you would think, if you're a Democrat president and you're sitting there supposedly representing the common people, when a Rockefeller knocks on the door, you know, you might want to listen to him, but, I mean, somehow everything that those people wanted would happen.
Would happen.
Oh, right. We're going to break up Standard Oil. Fine. So it's harder to control now almost, you know.
That's right, exactly.
Because it's like a Medusa. The snake has grown several extra heads, so instead of just looking out for one of these things, now you've got 10 of them or 11 or however many Standard Oils they made.
Well, and the other thing that did was to make it so that any rival to come after that could not monopolize.
That's an interesting time in history. And there's another thing that came on that came later. But, yeah, it was true. And this is what's so interesting. While Teddy was shaking his fist, doing the old trust busting thing, Philander Knox was making sure that as a former, if he ever was a former, lawyer for the robber barons and eventual Secretary of State under Taft, that Teddy went out and sold it. Everybody felt good. Now, we broke up the conglomerates and all that, but they didn't, not really. And as Gordon said, and then what they did is when the horse was out of the barn, they closed the doors and called it a victory. No, sorry, it's already happened.
Elihu Root, was that it?
Elihu Root, that's one of them, yep. Now, here's another thing that's interesting. Hoover lost the election to Roosevelt, FDR. Or did he not run again? All right. I don't want to get bogged down in that. But anyway, here's the situation.
He did not run.
He did not run. Okay. I don't know.
I don't think. I don't think he ran.
No, I don't think he did either. I'm trying to, like, remember.
Who did FDR beat the first time?
Was it Landon? I mean, he smacked down everybody, whoever it was.
Landon was 36.
I should know this. I should know this.
All right, I'll tell you what. I'll lay it on you real quick. I went to POTUS. I'm calling it up now. The first election he beat. No, he beat Hoover in 32.
Oh, he did beat Hoover.
Yep, he beat
Landon in 36.
That's right.
Right, and then Wilkie in 40 and Thomas Dewey, and that's another. That is one of your all-time stolen.
I'm thinking of Coolidge. I do not choose to run.
Yeah, well, nobody knew that he did when he wasn't. So go back to Vermont, Calvin. Anyway, but what was interesting is in those days, the incoming president didn't really take office till March. So you had this kind of like 90-day or 60-plus day period. And what I found was they asked, whoever they are, asked FDR to go ahead and sell the banking holiday. And he's like, no way. No, no, no. Give it to Herbert. He's on his way out. And, well, Herbert said, I'm not doing it. And then not only did FDR do it, but he did it with this full support, a complete 180 from the way he felt about it. That shows you, I believe, the machinations involved with those who are behind the curtain and who they put out front. They eventually
James
told
– Montgomery documents that.
Is that. Does he do that in what, Country Defeated in Victory?
Yes.
Okay. And that's something that everybody should read, really. That's on the Angie site, thinkofbeaten.com. Hit the informer / Montgomery's writings, and you can read that book, and that sets up a lot of what happened. And also there was a character in there, too, that Gordon had pointed out, John, who was a John Sherman. He was also the Sherman Antitrust Act, and he was anything but a trust buster either. He was another fake who got banking off and running. So another personage pops up, like Philander Knox, probably two characters that nobody knows about and had an impact on us to this very day.
Sherman was inviting the bankers in on the cut.
So, at any rate, we'll be wrapping it up very shortly. And I don't think the comparisons. There's plenty of comparisons that you can see, you can find on the internet. That's all right. I mean, anybody can answer their own questions with regard to that. But I do have a couple of more thoughts, and I'd like you to respond to them. And then, if you guys want to give summary comments, we'll do that at the end. If
sure.
I were to say, and I'll throw this to you first, John. If I were to say, if one of the two authors could be somewhat connected with focusing on the evilness of government or the evilness of people, between those two, would you affix either of them to one in particular, focusing on the evilness of government or the evilness of people?
This is interesting. I think probably Huxley liked people more than Orwell. Orwell was sort of a misanthrope in a way. He was also supposedly a misogynist and a homophobe a bit. But so he kind of had a dim view of humanity. And so maybe that colored the way he went with his totalitarian boot in the face. And it's also been speculated. I watched a Christopher Hitchens interview on the Internet the other day discussing Orwell. And he said Hitchens speculated, I think it was speculation, that he felt that when Orwell was a policeman in Burma, he thinks that Orwell may have gotten a bit of a taste for sadism, you know, mistreating prisoners. And that's why he left. He saw his humanity drifting away from him. And that's why he got out of the business of being a cop, a colonial cop. Whereas Huxley, yeah, I think Huxley probably had a better view of humanity than Orwell did. And now here's another interesting thing. I want to ask both of you as Christians, you know, we look at Orwell. He basically was a non-believer. At best, he's an agnostic, if not an atheist. He did not believe in an afterlife, as far as we can tell. Whereas Huxley definitely believed in God. He believed in an overwhelming a force that ruled the universe, and he felt that there was an afterlife, obviously. And on his deathbed, of course, famously he had his wife give him an injection of LSD to help him with the transition to his transcendental beyond. And I would like to ask you too about that. How you feel about that,
Gordon? Can I hit that first?
Yeah.
All right. Here's my thought. it is not uncommon to find, for lack of better words, people don't want to use the word occult, but you'll find in other religions, whether it's the OTO, any of that, where they all believe in a God. There's a lot of God talk. If you see some of these motivational speakers on PBS, there's God talk. But they don't really say what kind of God. They believe in some kind of power. Oh, that's great. And so it's not unusual to find an individual like Huxley, who may not have been, shall we say, a Bible believer, but believed that there would be an afterlife and that there was a God or some super being. With Orwell, you had said it before. I mean, he may have wound up as a curmudgeon and a major grump. And why else in the world would you want to live in Jura during the last years of your life? But to see that, that seems to me to be an extension of throwing your hands up in the air and saying the whole thing sucks and then just walking away. That's what I see. I don't think anybody's really an agnostic, but that's not what you asked me. I believe everybody's got a stance whether they know it or not. And I would not find it unusual for someone who probably got very disenchanted and even perhaps hateful toward humankind to just say, let's not hope for something after this. Whereas someone can be spiritually motivated like Huxley, but the question is, what's the spirit? So that's where I'll go with that. And what I'm saying is the God that Huxley might have had in mind or whatever may not have been the
one.
Well,
yeah, definitely Huxley didn't believe in the Christian vision of,
right.
You know, the tetragrammaton ruling all things with the mm-hmm. Son and the Holy Spirit. But he did believe that there was an organizing force to the universe, a transcendental force, and that
yeah.
there was an existence after this life.
But that's widely prevalent in almost any kind of religion.
Yeah, sure. I mean, and I understand that you could see that, that's a lot of occult philosophy. Of course, Huxley called it the perennial philosophy. And he was interested in those things.
All right, Gordon.
Okay, Gordon, go ahead.
Thank you, John.
And what the question again, John?
No, I just wanted to know how you felt about, evidently Orwell didn't have any belief. You know, he was guess at the end he was interred in an Anglican graveyard, but supposedly it was just because he appreciated tradition and the but he wasn't a believer, anyone can tell.
That's true.
So I just, how do you feel? I mean, do you think that because of that, do you think ironically maybe there's more humanity in Orwell than in Huxley? Because Huxley is—he's a hard guy to get a handle of. I don't know if I should bring this up, but I noticed I was reading a book of criticism on Huxley, and I noticed that he got a lot of flack from some critics, mainly because of his overt heterosexuality. He loved women, so I got a feeling that, if he had been gay, maybe he would have gotten a little more critical. Respect as a novelist, but I agree. I don't think Huxley was as good a novelist as Orwell. I think Orwell is a much better writer of novels. Huxley's strength was in his essays, I felt.
Gordon, that original question, and then John tagged that on about, is it interesting to find that Orwell may have not believed in a god and Huxley did? And that original question is, if you could affix an author, one of the two men, to focusing one on the evilness of government and or the evilness of people, did one author strike you as focusing more on one of those two elements than the other?
Yeah, I would say Orwell focused more on the evil of people. And actually, my take on Orwell is that, and Huxley is of course different. When I look at the two, I see in Orwell, he was a curmudgeon, he was a hermit at the end, and I believe, and from all that I've read and all that I see, it was Englishmen he was sick of, really. I think he cared for people so much that they let him down so terribly often and so much that he just got fed up. And there are accounts in his life where he did care for people just not the people of his ilk, of his class. For example, when he was in when he was a constable in India, in one of the biographies of him, I read this, he was considered kind of an oddball by his fellow policemen, fellow English policemen in India, because he hung out with the Indians more. I'm sorry, with the Burmese more, or wherever he was, Burma or India. He would hang out with the natives more than his own people, and they thought he was weird for that. And and another example where during World War II, say Aldous Huxley, and I say this was one of the, I think, several times in Huxley's life where I know Thomas Mann referred, the novelist Thomas Mann referred to Aldous Huxley as an escapist. He said when things got tough, Huxley would try to escape. And this is one of the times where Huxley and his wife traveled the world, just went on holiday, I guess, during World War II, whereas Orwell stayed behind and did the broadcasting thing. And Orwell was noted for his patriotism, not nationalism, but he was staunchly against Hitler, and he apparently wanted to do his best to try to help stem the Hitlerian tide and help England win the war. But, of course, what happened was he got his dose of horrible propaganda, the horrible procedures at the BBC. And so he eventually and pretty quickly walked away from the BBC. He was let down again by his own people. I think Orwell liked people a lot. They didn't live up to his ideals. I think he was a very idealistic guy, and he just routinely got disgusted with people until by the end, he just became a hermit.
Well, you know, in Pritchett's short essay on Orwell, mainly he said he met him several times and knew him a bit, and he didn't know him really well, but he had spent some time with him. And he mentioned that Orwell, while he was working at the BBC during the war, also had a day job. He was making parts for airplanes in a factory.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. I was kind of amazed that he had actually done that. And so that tells you something about the man. You know,
That fits with what I've read about him.
Yeah. You know, he respected, because he was a socialist, and he called it the way he saw it. You know, he did not like the Stalinist version of socialism, but he was a member of the Labor Party at the time. And
that's another thing that tells me he liked, deep down anyway, he liked people so much that when he was a socialist and he was for equality and all of fairness, but when he got a whiff of first Stalinist socialism, and then later on, when he saw the similarities in the Fabian socialism, and he balked at that.
And he ran away to Jura.
Yeah.
Take that, everybody. That's something I'm doing. Like I said, I'm trying to.
And Huxley ran away to sunny California to hang around with the Hollywood crowd.
But
yeah.
That's fitting, though. That's absolutely
two different
fitting.
Ways
you know
of running away, yeah.
If I had a choice, I'd go to California.
California Jura.
Well, Huxley was a little more well off.
But remember something also, as far as their attitudes. I don't know if it was just simply being condescending. I don't know if that's the word for it. Or a kind of a sunshine, social type response. All right, here's where I'm going with this. Do you guys remember Catherine Mansfield's story, The Garden Party?
A long time ago.
I
don't.
Okay, well, it came to mind that you have sunshine, socially minded people. And the point here is calling them sunshine because from a distance they can pontificate about the plight of the poor. And if I remember correctly, in the Mansfield story, you have there's a party being held, and one of the characters, a female, is like, has this kind of like removed, sunshine, social-minded attitude toward workers. But when it really gets down to getting your hands dirty with trying to help the poor, no. I will have to say, with regard to both men's experiences, I won't accuse Huxley of being like that when he went around touring the mines and such in their abject conditions. But that's as far as I think it went with him, as far as getting his trousers dirty. Remember, Orwell went around ducking bullets in the Spanish Civil War and was a policeman, etc. So you can
understand. A minor.
Well, I mean, you can understand if Orwell became even more misanthropic or whatever, because he'd been through it. He had seen it. And, you know, he'd gotten down and dirty with it, where I believe Huxley was always like a little bit removed. And I can't really.
Huxley was, well, one of the criticisms of Huxley is that he was so erudite. He had so much knowledge and so much awareness of literature and art that it almost hogtied him as a creative writer, that he was unable to really enter into the top notch of writing, because when you're being creative, you need to have a kind of ignorance of other things. You can't let it influence you too much. Whereas Huxley was so aware of every word he wrote and every allusion and every other writer that had ever written a similar paragraph or passage, that it really handcuffed him from really letting loose as a great creative writer. And I find that the case. I find that Huxley's novels are a bit stilted because of that. And he was very well educated and very knowledgeable, and also he didn't put himself in harm's way. But part of that was because he was almost a blind man from youth.
That's true,
He was legally blind, so he could not exactly go off and have the adventures that some others might have.
Yeah, and that's not saying that he wouldn't. You're right. I mean, you are a victim of circumstance. But that he didn't, and again, I think that shapes you. And that's, it's funny, when I think about this discussion about Huxley and Orwell, it reminds me back to the rather acrid discussions that took place between Norman Mailer and, like, Gore Vidal.
Mm-hmm.
And if I'm sitting there looking at it, back in those days especially, it's like, if I got to take my pick, it's like, shut up, Gore, I want to hear Norman, you know? And it's the same thing here with Orwell, obviously, being...
Well, just saying, who's the one you'd rather have a beer with,
you know? Yeah, Norman.
But if I was being invited to a dinner party, I'd go to Aldous's house.
Yeah. Yeah, just watch the unsealed bottles, that's all. I want to get to three more items, and that sounds like it's going to be laborious, but it's not. The one that I think is the most serious of the other two, and there are going to be reactions I'm going to ask you folks to make toward the comments. But there's something going on today, and a listener had written to me with regard to what Orwell had written about nationalism and patriotism. All right, so that's an Orwell thing, and I don't mean to exclude Huxley from the operation. And John, if you can see something in this that's Huxleyan as well, fine. If not, I'm just going to ask you both to chime in on this. I'm going to cut this one paragraph down to just the essentials. And it's the difference between nationalism and patriotism. And let me just say, this is Orwell writing, patriotism is of its nature defensive, both militarily and culturally. Nationalism, on the other hand, is inseparable from the desire for power. The abiding purpose of every nationalist is to secure more power and more prestige, not for himself, but for the nation or another unit in which he has chosen to sink his own individuality. We are coming up on a time, and that would be September 11th of this year, where I think you're going to start to see a real groundswell of patriotism. But I think if I got it right as to what the powers that be are going to use this moment for, that we might not necessarily be morphing into a nationalism that will come in handy if we're going to get into it down and dirty next year someplace. Patriotism, I also think, is a crock of crap. But we'll just say it'll start off patriotic. I love my country. I love my plantation. But nationalism is, we're right all the time, and no matter what it is, we're right. But what Orwell had said about both of them, remember, patriotism is defensive in nature. Nationalism is inseparable from the desire of power. One, I'm going to ask you both, Gordon, you first, what stage do you think we're in, if we're in any of them at all? And do you necessarily believe that patriotism might be the entree, if you will, to nationalism?
First of all, this question is actually central to the difference between the predictions or projections of Orwell versus Huxley, because the few times they would talk about the differences between their books, this is what they always focused upon. Huxley predicted a time when there wouldn't be any more nationalism or patriotism. And Orwell's answer was, basically, you can't genetically, he didn't think you could genetically program people to get rid of patriotism. It's inbuilt in them. It'll always be there. All right. So what stage are we in? I'd say since 9/11, we shifted into the belligerent nationalism stage. And unfortunately, even, I think this gets to the third part of your question, I think even patriotism can be manipulated. That's the inherent flaw in it. And when, and as predicted by Orwell, evil governments can manipulate that, and they can attack their own people and blame it on a phony outside source to whip up war fever to get that people to go to war for them. And then it, of course, enriches the few people in power. And so it takes advantage of their innate patriotism. So, as you said, both patriotism and nationalism, they're no good, both of them.
Okay. John?
Yeah, I think the job, you know, since 9/11, I think the government has almost been on a program, a directed program to confuse patriotism with nationalism and the other way around. The patriot, the idea of defending your homeland against an invader is good. You know, I think we can all agree with that. But the nationalist, of course, wants to invade somebody else's homeland. And they have to convince the American people or the people of any country that you have to go to another place to defend your place. And that's pretty tough to do. I mean, for a long time, before World War I, they spent how many years trying to convince the people that the Boche was bad enough to go over there, and, you know, you went through that thing with the Lusitania and all the machinations involved in convincing the people to go fight a European war. And then again, before a generation was up, it was done again. And now we have, because a building is blown up, we've been convinced to invade at least two countries on the other side of the world that really had nothing to do with those buildings being blown up. So you convinced patriots to engage in a nationalistic undertaking. Well, actually, it's more almost corporatist undertaking than a patriotic undertaking. But everyone over there thinks they're being patriotic by fighting in Afghanistan or Iraq to as some kind of a revenge for 9/11. And so it's so easy to do that, I mean, to confuse the issue. And instead of enlightening the issue, the government for the past 10 years has been confusing the issue, and it continues. You know, I voted for Barack Obama last time thinking somehow, foolishly, that I would get someone who was going to end some wars that I didn't like. And, of course, I didn't get that. So, yeah, I was bamboozled, too. And you know, the point is, you know, unless the enemy's, like, landing on the beaches, I don't think we should be fighting any wars, almost.
But you raise a good point. Now, consider this. We could say the 20th century is the century of American warfare. I mean, we've been literally at war for a century, even unto now. But catch this. How in the world do you take a population in, 1918, and threaten them with the fact that the terrible Hun is going to come across the ocean? It's like a, what's-his-face said, Smedley Butler said, it's like, okay, you're going to establish a beachhead where? Rockaway? I don't think so. And they got everybody worked up, although I think there was a great percentage of the people in the United States at that time wanted no part of this. But still, they used the Hun. And this is where it goes, like you said, John, about taking patriotism in the defense of one's country. That sounds good. That's true. what happened was the manipulation was taking patriotism and affixing it abroad. There you go with the nationalism. So you got the United States jumping over the pond in World War I. And if it wasn't bad enough, another 20 years, you're back a second time. And then after the war to end all wars, the second time around, because World War I was the war to end all wars, and II was the war to end all wars. And here we are in Korea. It's like, what are you people thinking? But they were manipulated. And again, it takes the patriotism, if you want to call that the more benign element, and it definitely turns it into nationalism, which I think is much more pernicious. And so now we have this great amalgamation that's a double talk again, and that is we're safer here because we're fighting over there, and yet if we were to believe the 9/11 events were perpetrated by bad old Islam, they were here. So why are we going to go fight the guy down the block when the guy down the block is basically in your backyard? You know what I mean? It's like, no, the problem was here, not with them over there. You don't let them in, they don't come over here. So you've got this duality going, and people bit on it. You know, and I'm even sitting here now thinking about Bush's, you know, dictum about we're safer here because we're fighting over there. I'm like, no, we're not.
No, we're not.
No.
And we're definitely not economically as secure because, you know, we've gone broke over $1 trillion fighting these ridiculous wars.
The second point on this, on my last 3 points I wanted to use to close the show, I thought you'd find this interesting. It's on the L.A. Review of Books website. Real quick, it said, Orwell had not yet written 1984 when he first questioned his former teacher's prescience. In the early 40s, a reader of his newspaper column solicited Orwell's opinion of the danger that consumerism and the pursuit of pleasure posed to society. Orwell replied that, in his view, the time to worry about Brave New World scenarios had passed, for hedonism and vulgar materialism were no longer the great threat they had once been. And this is Huxley answering. In October 1949, just a few months after Orwell published 1984, Huxley wrote to his former pupil to make the opposite point. Orwell's book impressed him, he said, but he did not find it completely convincing, because he continued to think, as he had when he was crafting Brave New World, that the elites of the future would find less arduous strategies for satisfying their lust for power than the boot on the face technique described in 1984. John, you just want to comment at that, or are you
all
right?
Yeah, that's yeah. I have the complete quote here, and okay. I was going to read it, but you went over it pretty well. I do want to remind everybody that Orwell and Huxley had known each other for over 30 years. Huxley was a teacher of Orwell's, for his French professor, Eddie.
At Eton?
Yes. So, and they had corresponded, and they had exchanged books. So, you know, it wasn't like it's like I'm better than you or you're better than me. They both had profound respect for each other. In fact, I have a copy of in my Kindle of Orwell's essays, and there's about 12 or 13 references to Aldous Huxley in them, and most of them are pretty respectful. And there's only one that I might say might be a little deprecating, slightly. And I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was I won't say it because I can't remember it perfectly, so I won't just spout off something. But usually Orwell was, had some respect for Huxley, and would speak of him in good terms, and as opposed to some other writers that were mentioned in the essays. So I think they had respect for each other. I think that they thought both of each other's works were valuable. And I think that probably, as we started at the beginning, as I started stating, I think that the totalitarian mind will use whatever tool is available to achieve its ends. If it's the iron hand and the velvet glove, or if just get the iron hand out and kick you around, I think it'll do whatever it feels will work.
Okay. Gordon.
I also think that we're starting to see, in the end, I think we're starting to see, in the United States anyways, a little more of us loving our servitude, as Huxley so famously stated in several times. That's about it.
All right. Sorry, John, for stepping on you there at the end. So.
No, that's okay.
All right, Gordon, go ahead.
I know that there's a tendency for people to focus on the torture aspect in 1984, and I can understand why it was so vivid. But I think that's just that. I think that's more the fictional aspect of Orwell's novel. I think he was using hyperbole there to scare people, to warn them, to get his point across. There's so much more of the novel of 1984 that's not focused upon. There's so many more ways of controlling the population. Torture was just the last resort for the government in 1984. Before that, they had keeping the people stupefied by poverty. And one thing we haven't talked about that was so prominent in the book was the manipulation of language to control people's thoughts. They used that on people, and we're bathed in that in our society. And a number of other ways. So to just focus on the torture angle, I think it's a kind of a, and of course that would be inefficient if that was the main way a government was going to control people. But no, that was just one aspect of the book. So I know that
the most basic means of control of all is availability of food.
That's, yeah, yeah.
Hmm.
You keep them poor. Yeah, so when people just focus on the torture, I think that's kind of caricaturizing the novel, that you just focus on what that would be, to me, would be like focusing on the Hypnopedia in Brave New World, which is one aspect of it.
By the way, I'm sorry, Gordon, if you're continuing, by all means.
No, go ahead.
Okay. A manipulation of language is very key, and one of the most glaring examples I've found is that if you look at dictionaries, and I always bring up the example of my 72 Webster dictionary, which I got going off to junior college, and I have kept it ever since. Taking a look at something in that book as opposed to the same word and its meanings in a recent and especially post 2001 dictionary, and that is the word terror and terrorism. Terrorism in that 72 dictionary is described as a government's actions upon people. It has since been changed, post-2001, to people's actions against government. Very interesting. Also,
well, the word fascism has been changed, too. They took off the corporate angle of the definition of fascism.
Okay.
And Orwell's essays, I did a little search on terror in there, and whenever Orwell mentions terror, he always is referring to government terror.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
right.
I'm talking about, you know, people lighting off bombs somewhere or whatever. He's talking about what governments do to people to control them.
I have given the book away. It may be in your bookcase, Gordon. I'm not sure where I sent what. But there is a book by Trotsky. I think it's called Terrorism and Communism. It was supposed to be an answer to some critic, and I mean, the book, you know, once Trotsky gets going, you know, forget about it. It's like 300 pages. But I find it interesting also in there that one of the things that was mentioned was a universal national workers. I don't want to call it act, but movement. And what struck me is that we had that legislation that came in as universal Military Service Act, and then it's been changed two or three times. The last version came out in 07 as far as I followed it, but the title has since been changed to Universal National Service Act. It took out military, put in national, and that phrase is almost exactly what is in the book that Trotsky wrote.
Oh, nice.
I find that just really interesting. Universal National, you know, Workers' Army or something like that. All right, be that as it may, what I want to throw out, and I'm doing it for to you first, John, and then we're going to let Gordon have the last word since you had the opening shot, John. But anyway, that's the way I planned it. It may not work out like that. Here's what I also want to...
I promise to shut up.
No, you don't have to do that. Oh, man. All right, now I'm going to ask you to react to this and then take it wherever you want to go. There is I guess it was an essay or something, The Perfect Drug, Our Modern-Day Soma, and the intellectual decline of America as part of the title. But I thought it was interesting. They're talking about what's the best way for government to control its people. We have the Huxley Better Through Pleasure, and I'm really being very general here. We have Orwell through totalitarianism, pain, fear. So when the word here that said, when you hear the word problem, and what I'm going to read to you, it is the problem is that of how to control a population. And here we go. One might suggest that the problem could be solved by banning or regulating television, either forcing it to conform to some sort of standard or else prohibiting it altogether. But government censorship would only move the country toward a different set of problems, the sort predicted by Orwell. Paradoxically, the only real lasting solution to the problem, which would not create more problems than it was designed to fix, is awareness of the problem itself. Last sentence. This was the message which Huxley was trying to convey in Brave New World. Entertainment in itself is not bad. The problem comes not when we start laughing instead of thinking, but when we forget why we're laughing and when we stop thinking. Go ahead, John.
Okay, I happen to be looking at a quote from Orwell, and he says, "A thing is funny when in some way that is not actually offensive or frightening, it upsets the established order. Every joke is a tiny revolution." And okay. I lost my train of thought.
No, we were talking about that comment, what Huxley was saying, and what the writer extrapolated with was that it's not when we start laughing instead of thinking. It's when we forget why we're laughing and when we stop thinking.
Okay, and before that you mentioned fear. You know, Orwell's totalitarian system using fear,
right,
and terror to get what it wants. But you know what? Our totalitarian system uses fear too, but not fear of itself, but fear of some vague other. And of course, Orwell's 1984 used that too with Goldstein. You know, we've created a million Goldsteins, faceless ones, wearing turbans that are out to destroy us. And it's almost a self-fulfilling prophecy, because by going over there, we're probably creating a lot of guys in turbans that want to destroy us. I think it's almost like, as I'm looking at it now, we've come to like, or I've come to like a Hegelian synthesis between Orwell and Huxley. I don't think it'll be one or the other. I think it'll be something in between that's still going to bring something bad.
I'm laughing in the sense, can you imagine this? This would be so purely American. We now have a vacuum in power, supposedly. Bin Laden really, 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 really dead. But wouldn't it be great if to pick the new boogeyman that we get a bunch of the Taliban or Al-Qaeda, whatever, have them come over and do an American Idol and let there be a playoff and let the people vote as to who they want to be the new boogeyman. I'm sorry, that was ridiculous, but that's what just came to my mind. Any rate, are you flipping it over to Gordon?
Yeah, you take it, Gordon. This, what you just described, is the perfect amalgam between the horrors of Orwell and Huxley.
But can you imagine guys coming out and doing shtick?
Yeah.
Forget it. All right.
And then at the end, they blow up the theater. Yeah.
Oh, Lord.
Including themselves.
You see there's promise in this, don't you? And there's a buck to be made, so everybody will be happy. Ay, ay, ay. All right. Sorry, Gordon. But go ahead. Yes, that would be a perfect mixture.
No, I think John's right. These two guys, these two men, Huxley and Orwell, they obviously, like any other two individuals, they had their own upbringing. They saw what they saw. They lived through what they saw. So they could write about their experiences. And what each of them, from their experiences, and because they were both such keen minds, they were able to predict and project a lot of the... about everything we're living in now. And I think that the future world that not only we're going to be in, but we're already in, it's an amalgam. It's between both Huxley and Orwell. And we've mentioned that already on the show, how young people today, most of them, fit the soft, technologically mind-controlled Huxleyan view, but there's this minority cadre of hardened soldiers we are brainwashing up. We're looking at a combination, and that's not new. A lot of us have already spoken about that. And that quote, specifically the quote you gave about not knowing when you're laughing, what you were thinking about, I mean, that harkens of mind control. And this is mass mind control. And both Huxley and Orwell wrote about mind control, mass mind control. Huxley had a number of various scientific ways that would be done, the hypnopedia and genetic programming, and the pharmaceuticals. And Orwell's way of that, that he saw that happening, was the language manipulation,
mm-hmm.
and the stupefaction by poverty. And all of it's come to pass, all of it. Oh, lest we forget this, let's not forget this. Another way to keep people stupid, because we talked about this just yesterday. We always talk about this. The rewriting of history that Orwell predicted. Man, has that ever gone on?
That's true. That John, you remember, was that, and I used to always gloss over this, and it was only like a month or so ago when it went, duh, I should have had a V8, and that was, he who controls the past controls actually the present and the future. And so sanitizing textbooks, history texts, and books for public, for widespread consumption, and that's exactly what Orwell said would happen, and in fact it has. I mentioned to both of you about that one article I got from the California Historical Society, their quarterly from March 1947, when it talks and cites newspapers and their accounts of Russian sailors, both in New York and in San Francisco, in the fall of 1863 through the winter that brought them to the spring of 64. Completely not even mentioned. Can't find a thing about that in history texts. And I just find that amazing that it was like, forget about that. As if we're not supposed to think that Russia at one time was kind of aligned with us, as John Bonanno pointed out before, too. There was a time when Britain and France didn't seem so warm to the United States nor to Russia. And that was their common bond at that time. That disappeared. So that kind of – and a lot of the stuff we talk about, John and Gordon, yeah, I mean, it's conspiracy. But like I do that spin on Harry Truman's statement, the only thing new is the history you don't know about. And I say the only conspiracies there are is the history you don't know about. Because therein lies the conspirators and what they do, and they have successfully brushed away their footsteps.
And Keith, that Russian thing makes a lot of sense.
Yes, it does.
When you look at what happened in 1863, isn't that the year we bought Alaska, too? I mean, right after that,
right in there.
Right in there. And so we must have had a very close relationship with Russia pull that one off.
That deal was because when they came over, the bone that we threw the Russians was to buy Alaska from them. That was the payment.
Viz, I figured out something from reading those essays that I didn't know before. I mean, and I don't even think Charles Wilcox explained this, because he didn't have to in his book, but it answered some questions of mine. Was the purchase of Alaska the only reason the Tsar would send his fleet over? No, there were so many other things. There was a revolt going on in Poland, and France and Britain were getting involved in that, and Russia wanted them to back off. And I didn't know that Russia, back in the 1850s, during the Crimean War, had made the mistake of letting its fleet get bottled up in its harbors, and this time around it wasn't going to make that mistake. It sent its fleet to the U.S. and kind of killed two birds with one stone. It wasn't going to let its fleet get bottled up in the harbor, and it was a direct, a clear and present threat to France and England.
John, also, I'm just reading from this, and it's going to be in your possession very shortly. But it said, moreover, the protection afforded the United States by the visiting fleet figured in our purchase of Alaska, then regarded as barren wasteland. It's not. Anyway, to which the opponents of Secretary of State William Seward, who negotiated the purchase in 1867, had referred in derision as Seward's icebox and Seward's folly. But going back to what you said, remember, this does make sense, because for the first time ever, Britain and France were allies in a conflagration. Think about that. And they gave Russia a bloody nose in the Crimean War. Russia wanted a rematch, but they didn't want to leave their fleets in the harbor where the superiority of the British and French combined fleets would have done them in. When they got to the high seas, they were the faster and more effective. So isn't it interesting that, in a way, I believe the Tsar was telling Great Britain and France, make my day. You guys want to come across either the borders, the Rio Grande or whatever, we're going to go. So it is. If you think about what took place in 1848, this was an extension of that, not even 20 years later. And that makes sense as well. And as we had said, Russia and the United States at one time had a little bit more to fear from Britain and France than they did later on.
And not long after the Tsar decides to challenge France and England, what happens? He has a whole bunch of revolutionaries on his hands.
You know what? Yes, and let me run this by you guys. What I always thought made sense, and this is another one, another element, this the Crimean War, and that is it is reported, I think, by, who's the gentleman? Myron Fagan, I think, that when there was talk of a New World Order in Europe, that they felt, and this could have been the Rothschilds directly, they felt rebuffed, in fact were, by the Tsar. Was like, get out of here, take it someplace else. And Rothschild and that power block said, okay, we'll straighten your ass out later. Now, that wasn't Alexander at the time, but that was the beginning. I mean, it was all the Tsarist line. And now you take the Crimean War and add that, and you've got Russia being, if you will, a gadfly again to European powers. And just as you said, payback time came in 1915 through 17. What do you think, John? Would that be kind of what you think also? Or
yeah, I think that and, you know, you have your interests suddenly. It was very interesting, but after that revolution, all kinds of Wall Street interests were suddenly
That's
working
right.
very closely with the communist government.
That's right. Yep.
So it's fascinating.
So the banker sent $20 million in gold to Lenin. Trotsky gets prepared with a number of people on the east side of New York. You know, who threw this thing, by the way? And, of course, when they went ahead and sent legations to Lenin, it was pretty much business. And the supposed Hoover Red Cross humanitarian legation were mostly businessmen, to include, you know, industrialists in back of, I think, International Harvester. So, yeah, who exactly threw that revolution? Who funded it? And then, of course, what was the purpose? So, yeah, you're absolutely right. Wall Street and the money people wind up in Moscow. Or at that time, probably we're in St. Petersburg. I'm not sure where that all started. So, Gordon, any comments?
Yeah, that all factors into Orwell's novel Animal Farm, too.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, another thing you can't leave out of who funded that, I guess who was the conduit to funding the Russian Revolution was the Red Cross,
That's right.
Raymond Robbins, and I think even Herbert Hoover was involved in that.
Well, Hoover led the group over, yes.
Yeah.
And what he's referring to, John, you may know this too, it's just that Rockefeller had had hijacked the Red Cross post-Clara Barton. And the one comment I found very interesting enough to get the book called British Agent by Bruce Lockhart, who also was a provocateur during World War II for England. But the statement that Lockhart made, that he said Lenin was a busy man, but there was one person for whom he always had time, and that was Raymond Robin, the hand-picked head of the Red Cross. When he popped up, Lenin listened. And there's your Rockefeller Western funding conduit to the Bolshevists. So, all right.
There you go.
It is interesting stuff, though, isn't it?
It all seems to link together, doesn't
it? Does.
It's a web, a giant spider web.
All right. Folks, this has been John Bonanno and Gordon Comstock. Both their websites' links will be up with the audio. There never seems to be an end to this, and it's okay. And what I'm thinking about is in a month or two, perhaps we'll do a show, because people are going to opine on all our sites and emails and have something they want to say about it or thoughts or whatever. And I think that's great. And I would like to give it 30 to 60 days to see if we could get enough response to do this again, because what these two men wrote about and spoke about is happening right now. And, of course, most of us don't even realize that it's happening here and as we speak. So
maybe we could generate some questions from listeners.
Well, that's what I thought I said in such a
Oh, did you just
Yeah, I know. But you know me. I mean, I'll go on forever. Andy Coleman is, I think he feels this is some kind of medication.
You've been talking to Colvin too much.
Well, you see, that's what I like to think. But then, you know, and he's laying it, you know, he says it's me. He says I have when I speak, it's dyslexic. I'm like, oh, all right, you know, okay. So, yes, you're absolutely right, Gordon. Why say, you know, in 10 words what I can say in like 150? And I complain about the Collins brothers.
You get paid by the word, don't you?
Yeah, well, I would have liked to, but that's not the way it worked out. So at any rate, thanks, guys, for being with us. And I hope down the road we can do something live. A month or two, if that's okay
sure.
with you guys. So we'll see how it goes. But again, this is fresh stuff. It'll be fresh for the rest of our lives. Thanks very much, both of you. Have a good day, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Bye-bye.
Bye, adios.
Bye-bye. Good night. Good morning.